Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
The Honeydew with Ryan Sickler.
Welcome back to The Honeydew, y'all. We're over here doing it in the Night Pants Studios. I'm Ryan Sickler. Thank you for supporting this show. Thank you for watching. I love my job, and you guys are a big part of that. So thank you. And if you got to have more, then you got to have the Patreon. It's called The Honeydew with y'all. It is this show with you all. And it is, I promise you, the wildest, best storytelling show on Patreon. It's $5. All right. It's been $5 since day one. I won't ever change it. If you or someone you know has a story that has to be heard, please submit it to honeydewpodcast@gmail.com. If you're on the fence, check out the best of episodes we've put up on the free YouTube that we do with Josh Wolf, and go check those out. And I promise you, you're like a cup of coffee, you're in. All right. I'm very excited. You guys know what we do here. We highlight the lowlights. I always say these are the stories behind the storytellers. I'm very, very excited to have this guest on, but waiting a long time, hoping this would happen. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mark Maron. Welcome to the Honeydew, Mark Maron.
Thank you.
Got yourself in, damn it.
Thank you.
Damn right. Thank you very much for being here. Before we dive into whatever we're going to talk about, right there, promote everything and anything you'd like, please.
August 1st, which I think will be behind us when you see this, my HBO special, Panicked, is available to watch. What else is happening? The Bad Guys too, if you got kids. I'm Mr. Snake. That's happening in August. I'm in the show Stick.
Yeah,
watching. With Owen Wilson. On Apple TV, and I've got a documentary about me, which was a 3-year haul called Are We Good? I don't know where that's going to be playing, but maybe by the time this is out, you might be able to see it somewhere. And there's I'm in the Bruce Springsteen movie too.
Are you?
Yeah, I got a little bit in there.
Not as huge. Yourself or as a character in that?
No, it's a very specific biopic. It's a story of the making of Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And I play the engineer.
Okay.
Plotkin. And it's a small part, but it's a part. It's in there, you know, and Scott Cooper, the director, wanted me to be in it. And, you know, it was kind of it's a funny story, that thing about being a comic. And, you know, I've been acting a bit, and I did a lead in an indie movie that we're waiting to see if it gets into Toronto. It was a big deal for me. And after that, you know, after being in every scene for a month, I had to do this Springsteen movie, and I re-looked at the script, and there was only like 5 lines. I'm like, what the fuck is this? I just did the lead. This is like an entry level job. I mean, why am I even doing this? Like, I'm not a diva, but it happened. And it got to the point where I contacted my manager. I'm like, what, why? They could get any guy to do this. And then I took it to the next step and I texted the fucking director. And I'm like, hey, Scott, I'm looking at the script again. Not a lot in there for me. Am I wrong?
Am I wrong? That's the way.
Yeah. But it's so like, what the fuck was I thinking? And he texts back and's like, hey, man, you don't have to do it. You know, we'll do something again some other time. I just thought it would be fun. And then right away, I'm like, all right, yeah, okay.
Yeah, you unplugged you right away, dude. Yeah.
And it was great. It was great because the funny thing was, is it's not a big part, but it's a pivotal part in the story, mm-hmm. the guy. And we're shooting in the studio that Bruce, you know, did a lot of the work in. But the funny thing was, is that Bruce and his manager, John Landau, the actual guys are just out at Video Village. They're there the whole time.
Oh, he is there?
He's there.
Oh, okay.
He's watching everything. And before—
Is he also getting a bit of a, does he have a say in like, I yes, think, well,
I
no?
Think
that,
I think Cooper wants to make it right. It's a very specific story about his commitment to the sound of the analog cassette tape that was haunting, and it is what Nebraska was. So after a lot of fits and starts and, you know, people pushing back on him, he's like, we just got to use that. We got to use the cassette tape. And they didn't have any idea how to get that onto a record with the sound quality necessary. So it's kind of the arc of an artist possessed with this sound and figuring it out. So I my character kind of facilitates how it's figured out. But going into it, I said to Cooper, I said, look, there's not a lot of footage on this guy, and he's a real guy, and I want to do, you know, respect him and try to get it right, but I don't know where to even look. And Cooper's like, don't even worry about it. Just, you know, just figure it out, how to, you know, how to be on the board and stuff. And I'm like, okay, man, I'll just do it as I feel it. And after the first take, where I'm doing it, I'm being the recording engineer, a lot of this, you know, he goes cut, and I walk out in a Video Village, and Bruce goes, you got it! You're Chuck! And I'm like, well, that was coincidental. I must have just summoned him from somewhere. but Bruce is, I had interviewed him, so I was able, it was kind of fun. Yeah. It was fun to do, but that's what's happening.
Well, before we get into your story here, I want to give you your flowers. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for, you know, being one of the pioneers of this platform. I mean, you got a fucking sitting president in your garage. Yeah. You didn't have to go to him. Like, you got the guy to come to your garage.
It's kind of crazy.
Which says a lot about both of you, actually. You know, any other president, I feel like, but go fuck yourself. Yeah. You know, you want to talk to me.
It was interesting. You know, I think it was a big bump for the medium in general.
Well, no doubt. It is 100% a tipping point of this medium.
Yeah.
When a city, so I also equate it to what Clinton did with the saxophone on Arsenio.
Sure.
There was, now he wasn't a sitting president at the time. I believe he was running campaign. Oh, I might be wrong.
I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have had anyone running.
But he came and went on these late night shows opened up this whole new avenue for politicians, presidents to go there. You're taking that with the medium itself too, where a lot of people still hadn't heard of this thing yet, and be like, now they're coming in and they realize, oh man, there's Home and Garden podcast and sports and arts and craft. Yeah. Like, I had no idea.
Sure.
You know, so you're a huge, that moment is a huge tipping point.
I helped bring something great to the world, but also I think I kind of released the Kraken as well.
Well, you can't not when you do something like that. You know what I mean? When you tear down the wall, they're all coming, brother.
Yeah, there's a few of us there. Yeah, I mean, yeah, people are always, the nerds are really like, well, there were podcasts, so, you know, way back. Like, yeah, but no one knew what they were.
Right. What's his name from MTV? The guy from...
Yeah, is it Mark? Not Mark.
Adam,
is it Mark Curry?
I think it was
Adam...
Oh, the guy with the pretty hair. I forget his name. He was very early on. And then
there was no way to listen to any of it.
Right. You had Rogan when I started, and it was you guys, like, Carolla.
Rogan came a little after me. Carolla had basically moved his radio show. Mm-hmm. But it was like Jimmy Pardo, Benson, Jimmy Dore. There were a few guys in our world. I think, I don't know when Jay Moore started. Hardwick, I think, started a little after me. Rogan started a little after me. I think Jay might have started a little after me, but there was a crew there that we were all doing each other's shows. It was a very supportive community back then. Still is, I think. I'm here.
Well, I wanted to ask you too, like, it's a life change for you to walk away from something that was not only so beneficial and so great to for yourself, for everything here. Do you feel a sense of relief? Are you a little nervous? Do you feel like there's this new chapter where you got to get into a new groove? Because for so long, this has been,
getting old.
In your fiber. I know, but
it's interesting because it's always been just me and my producer, and we do an audio podcast, and that was the way it all started, and that's what we always done. We're audio guys. You did radio, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the thing was,
AM radio station in college, bro.
Yeah.
Towson, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
AM.
They wouldn't let me on the FM, brother. I wasn't allowed on the FM.
Was it all Skinnered all the time? What was it? Here's another one from ZZ Top. Some of you remember this. You're like the Pixies, who? But the thing was, we never got into it. We didn't think we could make money. We weren't like jamming content. You know, we were very specific. And as the show evolved, we did a certain thing that was uniquely ours, you know, together. And he's a very brilliant guy, and he's a very meticulous producer. So I've grown to believe that we've talked to almost everybody that I could ever imagine and then some, but the quality of the thing has maintained and the audience has maintained. And, you know, we did all right. We got in under the wire on a deal with a platform, and we made out okay. And I think we got what we deserved, but then it becomes like, well, we've got this complete piece of work, which is 16 years of very specific and unique. Years.
Yeah. And you were twice a week.
Yeah.
So you're looking at 32 years if you were to listen to one episode
That's
a
right.
week. That's incredible.
It's crazy. So when we decided we wanted to wind down, the only thing that if you've done all right and you're not about just putting content in the world, and the risk is it going to diminish? Are we going to lose interest? I mean, it's a lot of work and we're a little burnt out, but it really comes down to like, if you don't have to do it, you know, like if it's ego. You know, why not just keep doing it? Like, well, why keep doing it? I mean, Stern, you know, God bless him. What I don't know, I've never said that in my life. But, you know, Stern.
I don't know of anybody ever.
But he was on his show talking about me hanging it up. And he said, well, if Maron's burnt out, I must be dead. And I don't think he sees the irony in that, because there is something to like that. Like, is he still doing it? You know, you don't want to be that guy. So I think in terms of the legacy, we now have an amazing piece of work that maintained its integrity and quality for a long time. And it's okay, man.
And will continue to also.
It's not okay
gone.
To leave. No,
it's still there to listen to forever.
That's right. And we're going to try to
like
find
Zeppelin
a place.
Like Zeppelin and everything else.
Well, I appreciate that comparison. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to find a home for the catalog, but it'll always be out there. But I don't know. I am feeling a little relief, dude. Because right now in the culture, it's like no one ever shuts up. It's everyone is talking. I mean, it's like there are so many, and I'm not judging anybody, but I see that I scroll through my, you know, sometimes on Instagram, and it's just like, you know, 2 to 4 white guys in front of mics talking about the last time they shit themselves as adults. And I'm like, is this where we are?
This is what you've helped contribute to society.
It's like, you know, but 9 different sets of them. I can't. So.
Yeah, you're not lying.
And also, like, everyone's got one now, which is, it's okay. It's fine. I don't feel.
Well, it all started, everyone. Once the internet hit, everybody had the keyboard and had a say up there. And
that's
now
right.
Everybody's got the microphone and everything,
and
the cameras
both.
And
yeah,
all
yeah,
of it now. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really kind of, it's not as special. And I think that we did something special. And, you know, by pulling back from it, it stays special.
I agree.
And I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I'm blown away. My first podcast, I started podcasting around 2010. It was The Crab Feast, and it was audio only.
Yeah.
With Jay Larson. And
I like audio.
We're older guys too. I'm still an audiophile.
But it's still
it's
like
the younger generation.
It's still
likes
intimate
to watch.
Though. You know,
it
it's
is.
Like it's a different thing. When I was starting the thing out, like people would come and they'd be like, oh, I don't have to do no makeup. And I'm like, no,
right.
Dude. You don't need makeup. You can tell all those people to go home.
You don't need lights.
Yeah,
yeah. What are you talking
about?
It was
just hanging out. And it was easier to get intimate and to get, you know, to get connected.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and these guys who were doing it on Zoom, I'm like, you got to stop. You got to get off the Zoom. I mean, it's got to be about the connection.
Yeah, you got to be able to talk to that person, see that person, feel their energy.
I think so.
So let's jump back to the beginning here. You're, from what I look up here, and you know, never all accurate. But
sure.
Jersey born,
New Mexico
raised.
Yeah.
Okay. What's that like growing up in New Mexico?
It was great. You know, it was pretty standard. You know, it was probably half a million people at that time. Albuquerque.
And you were in Albuquerque.
Yep. It was about, you know, 70% Chicano.
I was going to say, is it a good mix of people down there, diversity and stuff? You're not getting just white and black people in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
No, it was mostly, you know, white and Latino.
Okay.
But, you know, it was kind of like it had a pretty strong middle class. You know, my old man was a surgeon, you know, and he was in the service for a couple of years in Alaska doing his, I guess it would have been his internship with the Air Force. And it was just like an up-and-coming town, so we just ended up there. Mm. But, you know, it had a big university. It was kind of a life-changing. I love it there. But
You do?
Yeah. I go back. My old man's still there, kind of. He's half there. It's slowly fading.
That one we were talking before we recorded, I'm blown away. Both your parents are still alive and with us.
86. Well, they had me when they were children. I mean, my mom was 22. My dad was like 26.
Are they still together?
No. That's a long, complicated journey.
Okay.
Yeah. But I used to do a joke about it, about how my parents got divorced. When they got divorced, I was like, you know, 35. And I just didn't know who to live with. You know, I was like... It's a rare Marc Maron joke. But no, Albuquerque was great. You know, I got a nice mix of like just classic American townie and nice mix of, you know, kind of Chicano culture. And then I had a job across from the University of New Mexico. And there was a guy in the record store next door who turned me on all the weird art music. And there was a lot of art around. My mom was a painter. So I got a well-rounded kind of education. You know, plenty of Skinnerd. You know, and plenty of Brian Eno. I'll go both places.
Who? Give me one that you know, a bigger Albuquerque, like somebody back then that you heard early on that became bigger later that we all didn't know, like a Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Dude,
or Hendrix,
I swear to God, man, I saw AC/DC with Bon Scott open for Journey at the Civic Auditorium.
I mean, that's a hell of a show.
I'll be candid. I was there to see Journey.
Yeah, who? I mean, I'm sure you were.
and then AC/DC came out, and you're like, what the fuck is happening?
And that's Bon Scott AC/DC.
First tour.
Is that right?
The first AC/DC tour. And I did some event in San Francisco at some radio event with the bass player of Journey, and he swears that they opened for them. And I'm like, no, dude. There was no way.
He remembers it differently?
Yeah.
Does he?
Yeah, but there's no way.
No, Journey
was huge.
Yeah.
Huge. Yeah, so yeah, I saw them. Who else did I see when I was a kid? We used to go, like I had friends who were, I saw the Nuge probably three times. And I didn't even really like them that much, mm-hmm. but my buddy liked them. I saw Van Halen's first tour at the Pit. But I was too fucked up. Some guy from high school, you know, gave me a pipe and I took a hit off it. And I don't know what was in it, but I just ended up, you know, throwing up and laying on the floor. But they were four seats. So I was.
You were where you're supposed to be, right there, bro.
Yeah. I saw.
You were right where you're supposed to be.
I took it all the way down.
So this is what I wanted
to
ask.
But wait, we went to Sunday Jam 2 in Denver. We drove 10 hours in two cars. I just remember I worked at this restaurant. We'd gone there and kind of, you know, it was probably before they opened, and we just made a bunch of sandwiches and took a bunch of shit. I just remember driving. My buddy Chris had a Maverick, a white Maverick, and I had a ship brown B210 Datsun.
That's what we had.
Really?
Yeah. Datsun B210 brown.
Yeah. First car. And the whole way up, we were just throwing like dressing. It was just a food fight on wheels. But on that bill, we drove up there. It was UFO, Heart, The Cars, The Rockets, and was there one other one? There's a weird bill, but it was all day, and you're just out there in the heat. And my buddy, he's not really my friend, but Andy, he took acid, and you know, he was just watching a Mile High Stadium. There's a giant horse, and I think he was just watching the horse. You know, walk around the top. The statue of the horse was moving around. But that was, you know, growing up. We drove to Denver once before to see Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow because my buddy Dave was into him. And John Cougar Mellencamp opened for Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow in Denver after that first John Cougar record before he added the Mellencamp, which is a great record.
And then dropped a Cougar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. That one had I Need a Lover on it.
Won't Drive Me Crazy. That was a damn going.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's that scene.
You mentioned a friend, a pipe, all this. I know you've been very open about addiction and stuff. So what was the first thing that you took or that you had where you were like, this
is good?
Yeah. And how old were you?
Well, we were very good at, you know, drinking and driving, you know, in high school. You know, in Albuquerque, you got your driver's license at 15.
Is that right?
Yeah.
14, driver's license.
Yeah. 14, 9 months of learner's permit. So we all had...
And was it alcohol 18 or 21 then?
No, I think it was 21.
Because West Virginia, like when I was I in think it high was 21. School, was still 18. But I was only 14 at the time. And then it became
20. We all had these fake ideas. The funny thing about the fake ideas were there were about four of us that used to hang out. And, you know, we're kids. We're 15, 16. And there was a guy that used to go to show up at parties. And the way they made the fake IDs was that he had a board. You know what I'm talking about with the cutout?
Yeah.
With the New Mexico license on it. And he'd stand with a Polaroid and then you'd go get it laminated. And that was the thing. But he couldn't change the name. So all four of us were Tom Bynes.
everyone
was Tom Bynes. And if we were going to try to get into a bar, we had to like space out, you know, like, you know, you go first and I'll wait for some people to go in. But usually you're just hanging out in front of liquor stores trying to get, you know, shitty grownups to buy you booze. Mm-hmm. And they did.
A lot of them did.
They did. Mm-hmm. Pint of Southern, a six pack. I didn't love beer because it was too filling. So I would always get, because I was a Keith Richards fan, I would smoke Marlboros. And I would get Jack Daniels. Mm. I don't know
did
if
you
I
like it, though?
I don't think I ever liked it. Mm-hmm. But I was always the throwing up guy. I was always the problem. You know, eventually the evening would kind of revolve around me because they'd have to pull me off a lawn next door, pull over and get me out of a car. But it was booze. There was some, you know, some pills around, but not dangerous pills, just yellow jackets. You know,
what are yellow jackets?
Just speed.
White
Cross. And half the time it wasn't even real. And I guess I did blow, you know, pretty early on.
High school, we talking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely some blow in high school, but not a massive amount. Weed was around, but I didn't love it. I didn't really, it wasn't until I did my graduate work, you know, in drug addiction, you know, once I got out of the house. And it didn't really become a massive problem until I came out here and was a doorman at the Comedy Store. But in college, I was going at the Coke pretty good.
And was your drug of choice when you finally settled in? Was it Coke?
Yeah, Coke and booze. And, you know,
and
weed
booze too.
Sure.
Even though you didn't really like it, you just.
Well, you know, I got better at it. I grew to like it. I wasn't doing flaming shots of Southern.
Exactly. Yeah,
or chugging half pints of
what are you drinking?
Jack Daniels. I think I went through a lot of different booze. Vodka was, I think, the easiest. Mm-hmm. You know, that was always good, mixed good. And then, you know, if you really develop a taste for it, you can drink it straight. Right before I got sober, I started to understand scotch. I stuck with bourbon. You know, bourbon was always around. I used to like bourbon, but I wouldn't drink it straight. You know, just mix it up. But it wasn't until the problem, I think, really happened out here. And I've told this story before because it's a great story for drugs, but also for the Comedy Store, for kind of hero worship in a way, or being part of a celebrity situation that goes south. A lot of lessons were learned, you know, because when I came out here, I'd been in college, you know, 5 years. I was on a 5-year plan. Fortunately, my parents, you know, had money and didn't want me in the house. So I took that extra year. But I was doing a lot of blow and drinking, and I thought I was, you know, like the real deal. You know, when you're younger, you're like, I'm the shit. I'm like, you know, I'm hard, man. And I'm wearing, you know, like mirror sunglasses.
And are you a doorman at the time, or are you already passed?
Well, that's what happened. So I come out here after college. I go back to New Mexico for the summer. I'm doing coke, and I think I'm good at it. And drinking. Yeah, drinking and fucking. And, No, I had not done any comedy. A little bit in college, but yeah, you know, I didn't stick with it. You know, one summer. I was drinking pretty heavy then too. When I first started doing comedy, that was probably, I did a thing in college with another guy in a team thing, 84. And he went on to be he's a big movie director. And then I tried solo the summer of 84, 85, and I didn't do an open mics and stuff, but I didn't stick with it. And I waited till I graduated to come out here. So I come out here to LA and I want to be a comic. And I don't know how do you even start that? How do you even do it? And I go to the improv and I go to the comedy store doing what I think are auditions, but they were probably just open mics. But I remember I did the Monday at the comedy store and Mitzi was there and I had like 3 minutes, but it never went anywhere. I didn't even know how to follow up on it. So I started doing work as a PA, you know, just getting in that circuit where mm-hmm. you just get on shoots and you do shit work. There's a funny drug story with that. I was a PA on something called Kid Songs. They were making videos for kids and they had themes, and this one was a circus theme. So the Circus Vargas was docked out there in the valley somewhere. So it's just they're just buying time and feeding tigers and shit out there.
In the heat.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm out there like, half awake and drinking all night, and I'm just running around getting coffee for people. But they're doing they have kids there and a director and the clowns are there. I remember one night, one day after we shot the clowns, there were two clowns. And they're like, "You want to come back to our trailer, get high?" I'm like, "Yeah, fuck yeah." So I go to this like little trailer where these clowns live, and they sit down and they pull a bag out and he's rolling a joint. And I'm like, "Oh, wait, you got to take the makeup off."
Wait, they're still in costume, but like, no.
Yeah, I'm like, "I don't think I can handle it." Yeah, I'd like to.
You can't get high with clowns.
No, dude.
Yeah. I mean, Jesus. That would be scary shit.
No, yeah, I can't handle it. So.
Watching clowns do blow.
Yeah. We were just smoking weed, but it would have been good with the blow. So.
Oh, shit.
So what happens is this is the drug story.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the way through it, right? So, I get a job as a PA on some shoot that Mitzi's doing. She was trying to make a comedy channel. So she was doing this whole series of skits and sketches with all the comics of that time, where you probably wouldn't even know a lot of them. You know, like Karen Haber, Danny Stone, Charlie Burnett, Joey Kamen, Jan Hart. They're all the crew from the late 80s there. Because this was like, what was it, 86? I think, let me get that right. See, 81, 82, 83, 84, 85, 86, 86, 87, 81, 82. I think it was 87, right? So I'm on this. I think that's right. So I'm on a shoot that she's producing. I'm the PA. And I realize it's my moment. You know, I see her. And I go up to her. I go, "Mitzi, I'm Mark Maron. Do you remember me? I auditioned for you." This was like weeks and weeks after. And she goes, "Oh, yeah, you're funny. You can be the doorman. You can be a head." No, she said, "You be the doorman." And I'm like, "I didn't even know what that meant." She goes, "Go talk to Becker," which was her assistant, Mike Becker. So I go to Becker and I'm like, "She just said I could be a doorman." And he's like, "Okay, do you want to be the head doorman?" I'm like, "What do I got to do?" "Well, you just got to do the schedule for the rest of the doorman." I'm like, "Okay." But you had to be a comic to be a doorman. That was a system. So now I got the gig as a doorman. So now I'm in at the store and also the head doorman, which was a pain in the ass because, like, you know, she's opening a place out in Universal City and I got to get all these gypsies, like these fucking guys. She's like, get them all black jackets. I'm like, where the fuck am I going to find? So I'm down Chinatown trying to buy these guys jackets. Who are those guys? It was like Jay Pope. Mitch, what the hell was that guy's name? A lot of they're gone. Rod Blackman. So I'm in, and you're a non-paid regular when you're a doorman. And I had to. It was so funny because there were other guys who were non-paid regulars, and the belly room used to just be for non-paid regulars. And there was no produced shows, no nothing. It was all in-house. And usually, to get people into the belly room, you'd hang around that door in the hallway to the main room, and they'd do two shows or three shows in the main room. And when people were leaving through the back, you'd be like, come on upstairs, more comedy. And I remember that in order to get stage time in the—
And so then you didn't have to pay a separate fee. Once you're in, you go get up there and go. No,
it was like strictly development for non-paids.
Yeah.
But I remember I had an audition.
No, I'm sorry. I mean, as a fan, I'm leaving the show. I don't have to buy a ticket to go upstairs again. You're just saying, "Hey, if you want more, we got free comedy upstairs."
That's right. Exactly. Totally. And but I remember I had to audition for another comic to do time in the belly room. Yeah, because each of them had their nights, you know. And I remember I had to audition for this guy, Christopher Wheel. Well, I don't know what happened to that guy. He used to have a banjo that had an applause sign on it that he could light up. Anyway, he said, you got to do a few minutes if you want to be on my show. And literally, I did a few minutes for just him in the belly
room.
It was fucking nuts. All right.
So here's what happens.
At that time, you know, Sam Kennison was, he hadn't broke huge yet, but he, you know, he was about to. And whatever that mythology with him and the stories. But I had seen him on TV and I didn't like him that much. I thought it was a gimmick, you know, the screaming thing. And I, he wasn't really my bag. But, you know, he was kind of the, you know, that the comedy store is very susceptible to charismatic egos. You know, mm-hmm. the guys can take it over and it happens. And at this time, he was sort of that guy. But he was on the road when I got the gig and I met Carl LeBeau, his best friend.
I knew Carl, yeah.
And, you know, Carl was like, so you're the new head door guy, huh? And I'm like, yeah. He goes, we're all doormen. And I'm like, okay. He's like, so you're part of it now. And I'm like, all right, dude. And he goes, I'm going to give you a present. I'm like, what's happening? And he gives me a watch. He takes a watch, not a good one, off his wrist. He goes, now you're like one of us. You're in. And Sam was on the road at the time. I don't know where he was, but maybe he was shooting a movie. But that I met Carl first, and it was already weird. And because I was a doorman, you know, you're up for judgment. You know, you're a comer, right? So Sam comes back. And at this point, the alcohol. So I was living out here in Culver City with my buddy Steve. And then he wanted to move his buddy Pete Bergen, the director, who was just a kid then. And they moved me to the couch and I was being treated like, you know, they were kind of being shitty to me. And I got, you know, I got kicked out of there kind of. And I moved down the hall in the same building into this woman's house who needed a roommate. And within a week, I, you know, drank all her booze. And, you know, within 3 weeks, you know, there was an intervention. She, you know, brought her friends and her boyfriend over and said, you got to leave. And I talked to Becker and he's like, well, you can live up in Crest Hill, you know, which is the house behind the comedy store that Mitzi owned for comics. Mm-hmm. But supposedly we had to pay rent. I don't think I ever did, but we're supposed to. So I'm living in Crest Hill. I'm a doorman. And then Sam comes back from the road and he comes up to me. He's like, so you're the guy. You're the new guy. And I'm like, yeah, man. He's like, well, what are you doing? Where are you living? I'm telling him I'm up in Crest Hill. And like really one of the first times I met Sam, he comes up to Crest Hill with like, you know, an 8-ball or a couple grams. And we're just sitting there, just me and him. And that's the first time I met this fucker. And I think I'm a professional blow guy, but this is graduate level shit, dude. So me and Sam, you know, Sam's like, do you know his stuff? He's intense, dude.
Yeah. I am a massive Sam.
Okay, so Sam's like, Sam is Sam, you know, all the time.
And he really is. You say you thought it was a gimmick, so I'm saying even off.
Well, what I learned about him is like the gimmick was, you know, Steve Pearl. Well, I'll tell you. So I'm up at Crest Hill with Sam, and he's putting coke out.
Just the two of you.
Just two of us. And it's late. You know, it's after the shows. And he comes up there. And he's like, look me in the eye, Maron. I'm like, you know, and I'm just like this fucking angry Jewish kid, you know, from fucking New Mexico who thinks he's the shit. And I got my long hair and shit, my John Lennon glasses. Like, look me in the eye, Maron. Can't trust a man, don't look me in the eye. And I'm like, all right, we're doing this. I'm looking Sam in the eye. And he's chopping lines. He's like, I'm going to save
you. He's already probably coked out of his mind there.
Yeah, and he's intense. Yeah. And, you know, and he's like, I'm going to save you some time. I'm like, okay. You know, we're just doing blow. And then he's like, yeah, he's telling me shit. You know, there's supposedly lessons to be learned. And then out of nowhere, he's like, you ever burn money? I have not burned money. So we're going to burn some money. What? Yeah. So he pulls out like a wad of cash. And we're just sitting there burning money. And I'm like, all right, I don't know what I'm learning.
This is your first time meeting Sam Kennison. Yeah.
And we're burning money. We're getting jacked. And so we're fucking gacked, dude. And we run out of blow. It's like 2 or 3 in the morning. He's like, fuck, we got to get some more blow. Right. So he goes, let's go. And I'm like, where are we going? He's like, you got a car? I'm like, yeah. So we get in my Toyota. I got a little Toyota then. And we're driving down Sunset. And the dealer was right over there on Crescent Heights. Down Sunset, take a right on Crescent Heights. Those apartments right there. His name was Greg. And Greg doesn't know Sam's coming. So it's like the middle of the night. And Sam's like jamming on the fucking intercom. It's me, man. You got anything? You know, I'm like, what is happening? Right. So I'm like, fuck. And like, we're in the car. It was so funny because we're in the car and Sam's like all drunk and coked. And he's like going in and out. And I remember he jumps up. He looks at me and goes, I don't even know you. You could kill me. And I'm like, where are we going, dude? Where are we going?
He's worried about you.
What the fuck? So we get, So we're pushing on this scene, and you just hear this guy on the other end of the intercom, like, hello. And he's like, it's me. You got anything? Let me up. So we go up, and this guy, who was actually a hairdresser during the day down on Melrose.
Greg, hilarious, by the way.
Yeah, and who has hilarious. a woman roommate. And we get up there, and Greg's in his bathroom. He's like, what do you got? Just be quiet. Don't wake my roommate up. So we go into the back, and he's like, you got anything? And he gives Sam a bendel or a half gram probably. And Sam's doing coke. And he's like, got any booze? And all Greg had was those miniatures from the airplane. So Sam just like sits down on the floor. And he's like, got a little miniature vodka. He's like drinking it. And I'm like, yeah, nice to meet you, man. You know. And then Sam just fucking goes out. He just passes the fuck out.
At his this guy's place.
On the floor. And I'm like, all right, well, I guess I'm going to go. And the guy goes, you're not leaving him here. And I'm like, what do you want me to do? He's like, I don't want him to pull a Belushi on me. I'm like, oh, I'm a big-hearted guy. So now I got to get the fucking, you know, Kennison up. And he was,
Yeah, that's not easy.
Yeah, and I get him into the car, and I take him back to Cresto. And he literally sleeps on the floor in the living room. Like, just, you know, face down on the floor in front of the, and he used to sleep there a lot because we had a lot of parties up there. He liked to sleep on the floor.
He did?
Even in his house, yeah. So he's sleeping on the floor. So that was my first encounter with him. And then I was sort of in the, now I was in the group. Mm-hmm. I wasn't part of the entourage, but somehow I was in the group because I was the point guy at the store. So back then there was, it was like no cover night. I can't remember if it was Sunday or Monday, but there was one night that all the rooms were no cover. And that was like a shit show. All the freaks came in from all over Hollywood. All the metal guys from the Roxy and the true, and the other one, Gazaris, and all the porn people, all the fucking druggies and weirdos would come because that was Sam's night, man. Like, it was like no cover. And around 11:30, he'd roll in, hit the main room stage. And that's where, you know, he was doing that rock and roll shit. And that's where he became big. So my job became, you know, and I used to say, like, you know, we used to walk around. There was a couple of us lived up at the house, me and Fat Todd, and Schubert was around, some other people. But like, I used to say, like, I can feel him coming, man. He's almost here, you know. And Sam would show up with Carl and whoever, you know, drug dealer, whoever, porn star. And he would come up to me and he'd go like, all right, man, we're going to come to the house later. And he'd give me like $300. And I'd go down to the pink dot.
Back then, too.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't for coke. It was just to get cigarettes, get booze, get mixers. And like, you know, over time, I realized like, we got to hide shit because this is going to go on for a while. And there's going to be a lot of stragglers up there. A lot of weirdos are going to come. And I didn't, it was Mitzi's house. And I'm like, yeah, come on. And Tamayo Otsuki, who was a comic that Sam used to date, lived upstairs. So most of the time, after two nights of being up, Sam would just be pounding on our door. Tamayo! It was crazy. So we go up there. I go get booze and, like, you know, everyone, I knew what everybody wanted. And I go set up the fucking store for after this, set up the house for after the store closed. Then he'd come up with who the fuck knew who. Sometimes comics, sometimes weirdos, sometimes people that would steal shit. And we just do those runs, man. We do 2 or 3 days just doing blow, just up. And that was the fucking thing, right? And that went on a lot. And it became a little weird. Becker used to call us the Manson family. You know, Mitzi was kind of getting upset because she would still think it was a nice house. And sometimes, like, one time she bought us, you know, she had new wicker furniture delivered to the house. And, you know, and, like, lounge chairs with umbrellas for the patio. And, like, what is she? Like, we, you know, within weeks, we were, like, there was a gas fireplace. Yeah. And we're burning the wicker furniture. And, like, the umbrellas on the lounge chairs were busted within days. You know? And she's like, what the fuck is happening up there? And like, it was crazy. And it was a fairly condensed period of time. But what started to happen, what led to me getting sober the first time, was I still had to work, man. I had to drive the fucking Jeep for her. I had to do the phones. So I'm doing the phone some days. And some days I'm driving the Jeep, going to get her chicken salad, or driving, you know, the Axe to the Burbank so they could go to the dunes when she had a room out there. So I'd get up on 1 hour sleep and I'd go down the Jeep and, you know, like, I'd see John Mendoza and John Campanera going like, what the fuck, man? We're late. And I'm like, sorry, man. I'm like, oh shit, no gas. It was a fucking nightmare. I used to go over to Steve Pearl and Steve Kravitz's house because I needed to nap and they lived in Hollywood, the comics. I remember it was very funny. One time I went over to their house during the day with the Jeep and we went to 7-Eleven. I got one of those vitamin packs they used to sell.
Yeah.
And I bought a vitamin pack and I had it in my hand. I'm with Pearl and I'm like, I don't even know what's in these things. And he goes, you would pick shards of glass out of a half gram of blow, but you're worried about the vitamins?
7-Eleven pack. Yeah.
So because I wasn't sleeping, dude, I started to get psychosis. And I was already a little freaked out. I was hanging out with heavy dudes, pretty demonic. The store kind of felt as, you know, it was a little Satan-y because Kennison was a little Satan-y.
Yeah.
And the people that were around were a little dark.
And you got all the ghost history and shit in that building.
And now I'm starting to lose my mind. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to, you know, it wasn't even a conspiracy theory. It's some mystical universe I was living in. I thought, you know, Sam was a, you know, a agent of chaos. And the Hollywood Tower, you know, the towers, the hotel, Sunset mm-hmm. Tower,
yep.
That was all gutted because they were renovating it. So it was this big concrete gray structure that was empty. And on top of it, it's still there. There's like an altar up there. It's an altar structure. And I would stand on the fucking front porch of the Comedy Store out of my mind going like, something's going to go down. The end of the world's going to start up on that altar. You know, and I was like, I was out of my mind, dude. It was bad. And I was hearing voices and it was fucked up.
Really?
And, yeah. And it was like, it got a little weird and got a little scary, but I was hanging on because I thought, you know, I thought I had a job in the mystical, you know, like I thought I was going to be delivered some information that could possibly change the course of history. That's where I was at. And it got to the point where I was sleeping in my closet, you know, because it was got too scary. And I didn't know when those idiots were going to come and make me get up and do blow. I didn't have anything to come down. You know, like a lot of them had like mandrakes or downers or stuff. And I think there was even maybe some dope around. I don't know. But I knew the other people were sleeping. I was not. And I was drifting. And this was going on for a while. And, you know, I would put it up Sam's ass a bit because I knew, like, eventually you want these people out of the house. And you know, I was living there. And I knew his breaking point. And I would, you know, I would kind of push his buttons. And I was getting under his skin, and I knew that. But I, you know, that's the only reason why I have any sort of personality is I have enough fuck you in me to, you know, try not to, you know, get totally absorbed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so what happens is, there's a lot of this going on and it all gets weird, but there was this Satanist guy that used to hang around. His name was Dave, and he was like, he's a heroin junkie. And he, you know, he had like a pentagram tattooed over his heart and like
oh, nice.
Mark of the Beast on his arm. But he looked like Christopher Walken. He was not like a physically threatening guy, but he was a creepy guy.
Is he a comic?
No. He just used to hang around. You know, he'd show up and, you know, there was a lot of fixtures around. That place always had that kind of vibe. I remember it was funny, one funnier part was the room I lived in Crest Hill used to be Dice's. And one time Dice came up, he's like, you living in this room? You ever get a blowjob in the tub? And I'm like, no. He's like, oh, you got to get a blowjob in the tub. Like, there's all these people were around. You know? And some nights, like there were like one night, Ted Nugent came up to the house and we all had to not do coke because he's straight.
Oh, okay.
You know, so everybody had to behave and like hang out with the Nuge. And there were a lot of stars that would come around. I remember one time Tommy Lee from Motley Crue came mm-hmm. up to the house and I was like, what would a 15-year-old want to do? And I'm like, we got to do blow off the back of my guitar. So I'm sitting there with my Telecaster, you know, doing lines with Tommy Lee, that kind of shit. But so Dave London, the Satanist, Sam didn't like him, you know, because, you know, Sam was, you know, Mr. Satan. And
also comes from that religious background as well.
Yeah, I think Sam really thought that, I think he believed, you know, there were a couple of pretty, pretty good lessons. Like shortly before the shit hit the fan, I think Sam was still a preacher in his mind mm-hmm. and that he believed that, you know, if he had enough time to get in under the wire, he could.
I believe you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because some guy just wrote an article on, there's another brother. There's, you know, there's Bill
mm-hmm.
and Kevin who killed himself. And then mm-hmm. there's another one who was a pretty popular preacher for a long time.
Yeah. He was the oldest one, I believe, right?
The cockeyed one. Like, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know about him, mm-hmm. but I was around when Kevin killed himself and Bill was always kind of around. And kind
there's
of,
some old stuff on YouTube too of Sam preaching before.
Sure. Yeah. I saw some of that. Yeah. Yeah. But, what was I going to tell you?
The demonist, the devilist.
Well, that guy. But that like guy. Right before the shit really hit the fan, Carl had a wife, Christy, who went on to, you know, after Sam died, she had, I believe she had Sam's kid. Yeah, and I think that's real.
I met Carl, and he did share that story with me.
Yeah,
that,
and the Kennisons never copped to it.
The way he told me was they were all out partying while she's giving birth, and then they come back to the hospital, or maybe they're at a show. Carl comes in, and during childbirth, she says, "This is Sam's baby," or something like that. This is Carl telling me this before he passed. And
but Sam was already dead, right?
He was.
Yeah.
And no. He was not dead.
Okay.
No. Not when the baby was born. He was not dead. She said this. And the doctor tells him, listen, your wife or girlfriend is under a lot of medication. Don't even listen to what they'll say, the wildest thing. And he doesn't. But then after a couple of years, Sam passes and the daughter starts to look a lot like
Sam. Yeah, I remember,
and
yeah.
Carl actually was we got to watch my words. I don't want to say pioneering, but Carl was a big leader in. So he got stuck paying child support.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know, for his whole life. I interviewed him.
And he was, he went down to the courts here in LA and was fighting and was legally. So I actually, I'm pretty proud of this. When he first came back to California after all of it, and we're talking years later, I gave him his first spot at the Hollywood Improv in one of my shows. Because I knew who he was. I didn't know that had gone
down. I remember
when
he came back,
he was like kind of living in Texas, I think, with his brother, like off the books so that he could keep working and not be docked. Yeah.
Great comic. He was funnier than Sam.
Like he was great. That guy would get up. I'd see him do an hour, and I think he's going to come do the same set. He'd do a whole nother hour.
He was great. It was almost like performance art.
Yeah, he was great.
The Adventures of Red West, Elvis's best friend.
But he ends up, you're right, his daughter is not his daughter. It's Sam's. And
Christy was kind of kooky and intense. But they were kind of this weird trio. They were all fucking each other. Because that's the thing. I said, because it wasn't a situation where his best friend fucked his wife.
Right.
At the time, he was like, well, we were... Like, I don't know
who
if we
got her pregnant.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yes.
But anyway, so leading up to it, because Carl, they were all... They were intense, dude. And Sam was kind of a meanie, But I remember there was one time I was just hanging out in the parking lot of the Comedy Store during the day, because I lived in the house and I'd go make coffee and I'd listen to my CDs in the OR. I lived at the place. And out of nowhere, Sam and Carl on the road, Christy shows up in a new RX-7. And she's like, you want to go for a ride in my new car? I'm like, all right, get high. Okay. So we're driving around Mulholland, smoking weed in her new RX-7. Then she drops me off at the fucking store. And I'm like, all right, whatever. And then they all come back from the road. And Carl's all bitchy. He's like icing me and I'm like, the fuck is happening? And, Sam takes me out in the parking lot. It was at night. And he's got his arm around me. He goes, Marin, you never want to put yourself in a position where a man has to trust you. Because I'd fucking ridden his dumb car. Whatever. All right, weirdos. So I'm not the one fucking his friend's wife.
I love your impression of him. It's Sal. I can hear him saying shit like this to you with his little bit fucking head wrap and shit.
Crazy. I used to love fucking with that guy. But anyway, so here's what happens. This is the first bottom with the drugs. Because I'm gone, dude. And the night of Sam's HBO special premiered, that first special, which really made him, that and the record. And we all go to Carl's house. I remember I go over there with Richard Belzer because I'm hanging around the parking lot again. And I'm like, are you going over to Carl's? He's like, I'm not unless you're going. So I get into the fucking Eldorado. Belzer used to drive this Eldorado. He's great. He used to have a certain type of weed back when, you still had to look for good weed. He used to call it, I said, how's this weed? He's like, it's the hammer. He used to call it the hammer. So we get high. We're driving over to Carl's. I just remember we pull up right as Sam's crossing the street with some, kind of druggy girl. And fucking Belzer just guns it for Sam. Just guns it. And Sam didn't know who he was. And it scared the fuck out of him. And he comes around the car and he sees it's Belzer. He goes, oh, it's you. And Belzer says, yeah, I did that to Belushi once too. Look what happened to him. I used to love when people could fuck with Sam. Belzer didn't give a fuck. So it was the funniest thing about that thing is everyone was gacked and Christy had ordered a million pieces of sushi that no one could even think about eating because everyone's on blow. Yeah. So sushi was just sitting there. So after the fucking HBO special, Sam brings all his guitars and shit up to the house. And we jam out on the patio. I couldn't keep up with them. They were like kind
Sam
of.
Sam could play?
Yeah, yeah. He could play guitar pretty good. And Carl too. Oh,
that's right. He did the Wild Thing video and all that.
That was the downside.
He really did play. He could play it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he always wanted to, but he could never figure out. I used to ask him, like, you ever do guitar in the act? He's like, I never could figure out how to put it in there, you know, without being a hack. And then, like, yeah, the music stuff and that first record is the record. You know, in the HBO special, that was it.
Yeah.
So we'd have this big jam session up there. And, you know, Sam leaves the gear up there, his guitars and shit. And I put him in my room, you know, for safety, lock him in the room. And I can't remember if it's the day after or that night. You know, there was a lot of little events, but this was the main event. And I've told this story a couple times publicly. So we're going to do a party up at the house. You know, I go set the house up. And, you know, his guitars are still in the bedroom. And so a bunch of people come up, and one of them's the fucking Satanist, Dave London, who Sam doesn't like, you know. And we're all at the table, and we just sit at that big table and do the blow. And there's a good crowd of people. A couple of things happened that night. There was this little guy, George, who used to be the booker, and he was kind of a, you know, a little wormy guy, but he was up there too. And I don't know, he pissed Sam off somehow, and it got a weird vibe. It was like an Altamont vibe, like something wasn't right, you know. And your drugs weren't working. Yeah, shit was going down. Yeah. And, you know, little George pisses Sam off, and Sam throws a drink in his face and punches him. And I'm like, what the fuck is that? Yeah. So he splits, and then we're all sitting at the table, and Creepy Dave is there. And I think that George thing might have been, that was just the way that Sam fought. You know, drink first, and then a punch. So it might have been another night, because in the middle of the fucking, I don't know what day it was in this bender here, but Creepy Dave, the Satanist, goes, you know, you're not a real Satanist, to Sam. You know, I'm going to tell Anton LaVey about you. Anton LaVey, the head of the Satanic Church, who was like a carnival huckster and whatever. It was just dumb Satanist problems. So.
Just some Satanist bullshit. Yeah.
So, you know, Sam lunges over the table and fucking throws a drink in the guy's face, grabs his collar, clocks him, and it's like chaos. I'm like, what the fuck? And then I'm like, I say to Dave, I'm like, you gotta get out of here, dude. It's fucking, you know, this is insane. It's all insanity. And he's like, he's not leaving. So I don't know why, but I put him in my bedroom and I kind of locked him in there. I said, just fucking be cool until this, like, we can break this shit up. But it's all fucking crazy. And then I split because I got to pick my buddy up. My buddy, Bill Dodonna, I got to pick him up at the airport. He's coming in from Boston, and I got to go get him. And they're all, you know, they're all fucking, it's all crazy. So I leave the guy in my bedroom. I leave whatever's going on there. I got to go to the airport. So I go pick up Bill, and you know, I sleep at his hotel, you know, on the couch, because I didn't want to go back. It was too fucked up. And I'm telling him what's going on. I'm telling him, you know, I'm pretty tight with him. And, you know, we were just doing blow and shit. He's like, oh, really? All right. So we go sleep at the hotel. And I'm like, let's go back up to the house. It's morning now. And we get there. And he's still, Sam's still at the table.
He's still there.
Yeah. And this is most people had gone. There was a weird, I remember who was there, but I don't mention names because it was the end of the road for one of them who, like, that night fucked her up to the degree where she never looked at drugs again. She's a comic. There's a couple other people there. And I walk in with my buddy Bill and I see them all there. And I don't remember if I saw, but like I showed in my room first and the door had been kicked in and my bed's all fucked up and all the gear is gone. I'm like, oh, what shit. The fuck happened? So I walk into the dining room where the table is, and I go, what's going on? And I'm with my buddy Bill. And Sam goes, I pissed on your bed, Marin. And I'm like, what? He goes, I pissed on your fucking bed, Marin. I'm like, why? And he goes, because you let that fucking weirdo sleep with my guitars. This is how weird it got, Ryan. Yeah. And I'm like, what? What? And then, according to Schubert, and I hope it's true, I then turned to my friend Bill and said, I told you I knew him.
I just said the same thing. This is a guy going, this is the fucking same kid. Yeah.
So, hilarious. after that, you know, I didn't sleep in the bed again. I went over to Kravitz's. It was like, it was a fucking, it was, you know, it was like territorial fucked up, you know, cucking bullshit. And I was like, well, fuck all this, you know, and I'm already here. Like, I'm already sleeping in the closet. So, you know, I go to Kravitz's because he's out of town. So I'm sweeping over there and I'm like, what the fuck? And I'm kicked out of the group, you know, like Kenison, they're all fucking icing me. And there was this drug dealer that they all used to deal with, Majid. That was another fucking guy, dude. This Palestinian dude, Majid. Sam used to take him on the road because he was one of those guys, you know, no matter where you landed, he'd go find it. You know, he's
he's that guy.
Yeah, I remember one time I did a run with him. It was the highlight of my life.
Sorry. Sam would just take that guy and be like, you go find us coke while we're here.
Yeah, yeah.
That's hilarious, dude. What a job.
He was always around, man, you know. And, like, I remember one night we were up at the house. It was a big night for me, you know. Because Majid was, like, the backstory on Majid supposedly was that he, you know, he had been in, he was a Palestinian. He'd fought against Israel in the Six-Day War. And then he came here and became a citizen, went to Vietnam.
Oh, shit.
And I don't know if it's true, but the story was that, you know, one time he was on the ground and they were in the shit and the choppers were, you know, going to come in and get him. But they said, it's too hot. We can't get in there. And Majid said, well, I got you in my sight. So it's your call. Like, that was the myth of Majid. But now he's like this, he always used to say, it's only rock and roll, man. You know, like, heavy dude. But I remember one night, you know, we ran out of coke at the party and Madge was like, I'll go get more coke. And I'm like, can I go? You want me to drive you? Where are we going? It's like 3 a.m. He's like, no, I don't think you should come. I'm like, no, I'll come. So we drive out in the middle of the night and we pull up at a house. I don't remember where it was. And I'm waiting for him. He goes in, he comes back in the car and he's got like a half ounce. And he's like, you got a magazine or something in here? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I found you like some magazine in the back. And he's just ripping off squares to make bindles and he's eyeballing it. He's eyeballing half grams and grams with his fingers. And then he like, he's got this fucking half ounce of coke. And I just see him like scarface it, two fingers, like, with just, and I'm like, what the fuck,
man?
And I look at him like, can I do it? And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, well, I'm fucking living it, man. I'm living it. Fuck yeah. So anyway, so what happens, so I get kicked out of the group and I lose my shit in the parking lot of the Comedy Store. Like I just kind of break down because I'm out of my mind and I'm fucking breaking glasses. And I'm like, fuck all of you, fuck this place, Satan, you know, whatever. And Schubert, you know, Schubert comes out and he had kind of gotten sucked into the crew too. And he had been with Dice and then he went south and he was with them. He's like, dude, you got to chill out, man. You got to chill out. It's all right. It's going to be all right. And I'm like, you know, fuck you. You're one of them. You know, I'm losing it. And then the drug dealer, Magic, pulls up and I go, hey, man, fuck. It's all fucked up. I'm out of the group. They kicked me out, man. I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do. And, you know, Magic's just sort of like, yeah, you got to get out of here. Do your own thing. You know, when the drug dealer tells you to leave.
Yeah, it is time to go.
And I remember,
he's just like,
yeah, you gotta get the fuck out of here. So I go back to Kravitz's and I remember I'm laying in my bed and I swear to you, dude, because I always had this ethic about drugs that if I ever lost my mind, like you're going to know this time to pull back. I always had that in my head that like, you know, if you can't, but I remember I was laying in bed and I'm listening to the voices. I used to do a joke about it. It was like, when you hear voices in your head, it's never one, it's always many. And you spend a lot of time trying to get them to pick a fucking leader, you know? So I'm laying in my bed and I'm thinking like, you know, I'm like, how far out can I go, man? I swear to you, a voice, like clear, like outside of my head said, you've gone far enough.
Yeah.
So I packed up everything.
It's that Carlin acid joke, like, we're done.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't need to keep doing it. That's like, right. We're done.
That's right. So yeah. I packed up everything I could in my car. I paid off my drug debts. I gave away some shit, and I just left.
Cold turkey right there for your first try,
I left. I'm like, I was pretty sure I was going to be chased. I didn't know by what, either by Sam and those weirdos or mystical forces. Like, I was, like, way out there.
And where are you going?
I was like, I'm going to go to Tucson because my brother's there.
Okay.
He's in school out there. And I'm like, fuck it. I need a break. So I'm driving to Tucson. I remember, like, I see one of the worst car accidents I ever saw in my life on the road. There's bodies and shit. I'm like, all right, this is a sign. I got to get some rest. So I pull off, you know, between here and Tucson, I'm in like a Motel 6. I got a six pack. There's no blow. I remember Lorne Greene is on TV and I'm like, I don't know what this is it, man. I'm going down. And I get out to Tucson and I go to my brothers. I'm like, dude, I'm fucking, you know, I'm in trouble. And he's like, fuck, dude, I'm graduating. We were going to party. I'm like, new crew? Okay.
You know, so I'm back.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
But I go home. I go home and I eventually get back to Albuquerque. I tell my parents I'm fucking gone. I'm like, I'm fucking in trouble.
How old are you at this point, too?
Like, 22, okay, maybe, right? Still a young 23. Man. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, I'm just gone. And I'm like, I got to go to rehab. I need fucking help. So they check me into an inpatient program in my own town, which is kind of weird. So I'm at the care unit doing 28 days. And at that time, I had to wear certain rings because of the mystical shit. And I always had to have a skull on my shirt for protection. I was gone.
Yeah, gone.
But I get, you know, I get through it and I get sober and I get chubby. And it was kind of funny. Rehab and
you know. Can I ask you about the food at rehab?
It's just starchy shit.
Because everyone that's ever sat in that chair that's gone to like some kind of rehab or something swears that the food is fantastic.
Not this one. It was a chain.
You said
it was,
you got chubby. That's why I wonder. But you probably weren't even eating anything anyway if you're just coking your
way up. It was like my memory was it was like it was just heavy food. Mm-hmm. It wasn't good. Care unit was an okay situation. But, you know, they were just, you know, trying to get people to eat and get fat and. So I got out and I was like, all right, well, I'm sober. But I never locked in with the program. You know, I didn't lock in. And then I went to Boston and, you know, I got my shit together. And I'm like, I got to keep doing comedy. So I drove back to Boston and I started over again. Got a job at a coffee shop, was doing open mics. And I came in second in a competition in 88. And that's when I started working. And that was like that scene for work was it was a regional comedy scene. There was only... It was like you could work in Boston in the area because there was two or three bookers. You do one-nighters. So it was usually a two-man show. Opener do a half hour. Headliner do 45 at, you know, discos, bars, bowling alleys, wherever they could contract comedy. So that's sort of how I made my bones. I started working in 88. And there's some funny stories with the drugs. Because I got about a year and a couple months. Sober, cold turkey, didn't really understand meetings, but eventually drifted back into it, but never as hard as that. But it was funny. It was funny, the characters. There's a guy. Do you remember? You remember Frankie Bastille?
I don't know. Frankie Bastille.
That was good stuff. That was a
story. Comedy Store comic?
No. He was this weird road dog, and he was like a dope fiend. And he was like, there were so many guys out on the road back and then that were just like kind of, you know, skirting the law, skirting alimony, skirting child support, you know, taxes. They're just borderline criminals. It's like preaching. It's just full of, you know, morally bankrupt weirdos that are out, you know, kind of getting away with it. Well, Bastille was one of these guys. He looked like Keith Richards, you know, he had Tibetan Book of the Dead tattooed, and he used to talk like this, but he's pretty funny, you know, like, but there was a couple stories with him where, you know, he moved to Boston. He didn't want to be in the paper because he was late. He didn't want to pay child support. Yeah. He didn't want anyone to know who he was. And he was kind of an outlaw, but, you know, I have to drive him places. So he locked into me because these devils are like, this guy is like, he knows the devil thing. You know, he's a good devil babysitter. I was a good devil babysitter.
Yeah.
But, you know, you go to pick him up and you could never find his tooth. He had a front tooth that was missing. You walk down the hallway, you go, where's my tooth? You know,
it would just come out.
It wasn't a retainer thing. He'd put it away to sleep, you know, and then you have to find his tooth.
Where's my fucking tooth? Just one of them.
But one time, dude, there's two stories with him about drugs. One time, like, you know, I was just starting out doing these gigs. He didn't stay in Boston long, but we drove to a gig and he's a real road guy. And he's like, you got to do your time, man. That was the whole fucking, his whole thing was like, you got to do your time. That's what you do. You're a comic. You do your time. You got a half hour. I'm going to do 45. You got to do your time. And I'm like, I get it, dude. you know, and then, you know, we're driving, we get to the gig, it's at some bar and it's pretty well set up and it's crowded. And like, he tells me, he recites a poem to me called The Road. And I'm like, all right. Dude. So it's like, you got to do your time. And I'm like, I get it. And I go up there and I do everything I got, you know, it's close to a half hour. Right. So I do everything I got and I bring him up. I'm like, this next guy, Clubs in College, Frankie Bastille, claps. No one comes up. I'm like, what the fuck? I introduce him again. Nothing. Awkward silence. And then from the back of the room, I hear him go, 26.
Four more, motherfucker. He wasn't doing it all. He didn't care. You brought him up twice. And he's like, no.
26. So I did some fucking street joke.
Standing on business back there. Yeah. Ridiculous. Yeah. Also, that's funny too, because what comic do you know that doesn't want to do more fucking time?
I didn't have it. So I did a street joke.
Yeah, you,
yeah.
Him.
Oh, like, yeah.
Any other comic get up there for 3 fucking hours, but he was staunch. He probably only had that 45 hours.
No, that's he was trying to teach me something. Yeah. He used to do, like, just to get a rise out of me. Oh, he was not hacky, and he could definitely sell the material. But sometimes if I was opening for him in the middle of the set out of nowhere, he goes, remember the first time your mom caught you shooting heroin in your cock? And the audience would be like, what? And I'd be like, yeah, you're the real deal, man. But the other story with him was like, you know, there was a couple, but I was driving him down the Cape to do Johnny Yee's, giant Chinese restaurant with they used to have a Hua show and then they'd do a comedy show. But it was one of those, some of those Chinese places have the huge showrooms and it was a long-standing gig. And I'm driving him down there. And he's like snorting heroin. Dude, we're driving down, Johnny's, he's snorting heroin. And I'm like, all right. And he goes, you want to try heroin? I'm like, I don't think the first time should be while I'm driving.
I'm driving.
And he's like, pull over to the gas station. He goes in, he steals all the business cards from the gas station. And he's sitting there, he's writing his name on them. And I still got one. It's kind of funny.
Do you really?
Yeah. But so we're driving to fucking Cape. It's like 45. It was my hour. I don't know. It was Cape Cod from Boston. But like he's not enough. He's snorting heroin and he's fucking out.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
He's out. And we pull up to the gig and I got to walk him in because he's fucking nodding out. And I put him in a booth and I go up on stage and I didn't know what the fuck was going to happen. At this point, I'm doing my half hour and I do pretty well. And I bring him up and I don't know if he's going to get up.
Yeah.
And I brought him up, Frankie Bastille, and he lunges onto the stage and he just leans in. He kills so hard.
Come on.
He's sweating.
It's like a James Brown.
It's like a James Brown concert. And he just fucking nails it. And I was like, what the fuck? And we get back into the car within 2 minutes.
Boom. He just cries. Yeah. Hits it.
And all I think is like, that guy's a professional.
That's a pro. That's a fucking pro. Yeah. I mean, it really is. If you could get, that's heroin. If you could wake up out of a heroin sleep and then go, not just walk across the room, perform. That's impressive, man.
So, I was in and out, you know, I'd get a year and a half sober. And then I go out for a while, but eventually in what happened was, and that leads into when we do another episode is I was in New York. I'd gotten married and I shouldn't have. And, you know, I was back on the blow and I'm doing blow in New York. I had a fucking good dealer in New York, dude. I fucking love that guy. Hammerhead. There's like. I married a woman who was the best maid of honor at my brother's wedding, and she's all right, you know. But, you know, we were living out in Queens. My career was going nowhere. You know, I'm doing the alt comedy thing, and I'm doing the cellar and stuff, and I'm doing blow. And, it, you know, I always used to think, like, all right, if I start at, like, 6, I'll be done by 11, you know, with the blow. Mm-hmm. Like, that fucking ever happens. But I remember one time the guy I used to buy drugs from was this huge dude. He looked like Thor, the wrestler from the Ed Wood movies. Yeah. Shaved head. He used to live on the Lower East Side. He managed a building kind of. His whole apartment was like some sort of art salon. He was like a funny, intense dude. And there'd always be like celebrities in there. But it was like grungy. But he was a real a character. And I remember this is a great blow moment where I go over there. I'm like, I got to get started early because I'm married and I'm trying to hide it. from her. So I go over there at like 5:30 to Hammerheads. I'm buzzing. He lets me up. He's like, he hasn't even opened for business. You know, he's putting the blinds down. And while I'm there, so the buzzer rings and he lets the guy in who he gets the blow from.
Oh,
and I swear to God, this guy looked like a indigenous mountain person from South America. Like this Latino guy, old guy. He had a cane. He looked like he'd just come out of the farm, you know, but whatever. He gives Hammerhead the tinfoil, like, ball, you know, ounce or whatever it was. And the guy leaves and Jimmy opens that thing up and it's just this rock. And I'm going, let's do some of that.
I was about to say, this is all pre-cut.
I'm like, let's do some of that. So he puts out a couple lines and I did a line and I never felt anything like it. Like, just like this electricity. You know, peels back behind my eyeballs all the way down my spine. And I'm like, what the fuck? And I'm like, dude, why don't you just sell that?
Yeah,
and he says, because people would never leave me alone. And then he just.
Then Sam Kinison's will be ringing that bell all fucking night.
And then I see him just drop this rock into a bag of shake, pound it out.
Oh, that's terrible. Oh, that's disappointing. That's fucking great. I bet that was fire.
But what got me sober for good was I had surrendered, you know, to this marriage and to misery. And I was kind of, you know, bloated and sweaty. And I just decided, like, ain't going to happen for me, comedy.
You really told yourself that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would still do it, but I'm like, I'm not going to be a big star. I don't know if I'll get another gig. And, you know, in terms of like TV or anything like that. And, you know, it was like, this was like 99 and 98. And I'd had a couple of bad run-ins with the drugs. But, you know, I did one of my last runs was with Hedberg, you know, in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And they were doing that dope. And he come fully loaded. And I was not a dope guy, but he had all that tar heroin. And, you know, I'm smoking it with him, and him and Lynn are off doing it, whatever they're doing. But that was one of the last. I remember the two last times I went on runs. One was with Hedberg in Seattle at the festival. And I remember getting up the next day and being in the lobby of the hotel, and I just threw up in a blanket.
It just gives me more appreciation for fucking what's his name to pop right up and did his.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Threw up in a planter, got on with it. And then the other time, it was a 3-day run on coke with Dave Stebbins, who's sober. You know him?
Mm-mm.
He got sober too. But like, we were in the fucking hotel room at the Chicago Comedy Fest just doing eight balls. And fucking, I remember his brother worked at the hotel and he was kind of, you know, helping us get the blow. And I remember I'm checking out after a 3-day run. And years later, you know, I saw his brother and he goes, dude, I remember that day, man. You were checking out. And he goes, your luggage was sweating.
That's fucking crazy.
So what got me sober is that, you know, I decided that I'm just going to do local TV. I got some gig in New York for a local TV station doing this weird sketch where I set up a talk show on the street. I was already doing some Conans and stuff, but I was just like, I kind of given up. I didn't know how to get out of my marriage. I didn't know how to get off the drugs anymore. And it wasn't like I was doing them every night, but I was just one of those guys I was managing. And I'm like, this is my life. And now I got to own it. And then like a movie, I'm at the Cellar and this fucking gorgeous, gorgeous woman comes up to me. You know, I think I'm sitting at the bar with Scalero.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, 99. And, you know, I'm probably, you know, holding court like, well, I think Pryor was really the best, you know, whatever. And this woman comes up to me, just gorgeous, like model gorgeous. And she goes, you're Marc Maron, right? And I'm like, yeah. She goes, what happened to you? And I'm like, what? And I'm like, what? She goes, I can get you help if you want it. I can help you get sober. And I'm like, I'll do anything with you. So she was a comic and, you know, starting out. And she's like 23, 24, used to be a model, was doing comedy for a few years, sober as fuck. And she just started taking me to meetings. And we started a relationship. And that led to my first divorce. But she got me sober. She, you know, I'm divorced from her too. And she, you know, wants nothing to do with me, which is fine. But I do thank her for getting me sober.
And you've been sober for how long now?
Since 99.
Damn, good for you. 26 years.
Yeah, coming up on 26 next month.
Good for you.
Yeah, dude.
That's fucking awesome, dude.
Yeah. A lot of good stories in between those things.
Well, I would love to have you. I want to have you back.
You want the, yeah, we can cover the divorces next.
I was about to say, if you're willing to come back, I'd love to.
Sure, man.
But before I let you out of here, give me advice you would give to 16-year-old Marc Maron.
Really? It's basic.
Listen, that's what most people need to hear. It is basic shit.
Yeah. It would be just sort of like, dude, you know, fucking relax. Don't be so hard on yourself. You know, it's gonna be okay. I was always so fueled to this day with, you know, panic and, you know, kind of FOMO and just wanting to, you know, like, I gotta. It's just like, and also like, you suck. You can't fucking just lose that and try to, you know, just, you know, be in your fucking body, dude.
This was great. Thank you very much, man.
Thank you.
Promote one more time, please.
Oh, everything, yeah. My new special, Panicked, comedy special on HBO right now. Got the Bad Guys 2 coming out. I'm Mr. Snake. And you'll see me in the Bruce Springsteen movie Road to, what is it called? Deliver Me from Nowhere.
Great. And Stick.
Oh, yeah. Stick is always going to be on Apple TV. I don't know if we're doing more of those, but I think I did a pretty good job. And it's Owen Wilson, and it's a sweet, sad little story.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, thank you.
You got it. As always, Ryan Sickler on all your social media. We'll talk to y'all next week.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at cosi.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at cosi.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at cosi.org.